Hello and welcome back everyone to another insightful episode of Artist On Air. Today, live from Canada, one of the leading experts in brand positioning worldwide, best-selling author of the books Obviously Awesome and Sales Pitch, and founder of Ambient Strategy, April Dunford.
Here's a fundamental thing for people to understand about positioning. Positioning is all about how do we get to the best possible story that helps us sell the thing we have in the market right now against the competitors we have right now. This is not a strategy session where we're trying to figure out what should we build for next year or, you know, what's the vision of this thing? Where is it going? No. We're just trying to like sell the heck out of the thing we have right now versus the competitors we have right now.
Yeah, everyone, welcome back. And I have the pleasure and honor to talk with April today, probably the leading expert for brand positioning in the SaaS space. And of course, we start with a definition of brand positioning. What is brand positioning and how does April define it before we go deep into the topic? April tells me like what are signs and indicators for a really bad positioning within your market. And she gives a solution-oriented framework, the five most important components of positioning from competitive alternatives to market category. Afterwards, we talk about a good process to work out your own positioning. And there you will also get a little bit behind the scene and the secrets of the McDonald's milkshake paradoxon. This and many, many more insights about brand positioning, successful brand positioning for your SaaS companies can be heard within the next 45 to 50 minutes. Enjoy the show with April Dunford and myself, Julius Göllner. Let's go.
Artist On Air, the SaaS podcast for the German-speaking market. Valuable tips from successful entrepreneurs, top investors, and leading industry partners to help you scale your business quickly. Compiled by Jan Spandorski, Julius Göllner, and Matthias Ernst.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Artist On Air. And today, live from Canada, still in Canada, we need to say, April, good evening.
Hey, how are you doing? It's still morning here, actually. We're doing time zones here. It's so good to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks a lot for taking the time and coming to the show today. I'm 98% sure many people know you already, but as a ritual here on the podcast, we would be pleased to know who are you and what are you doing, April?
Sure. Well, my background is I started my career as a repeat vice president of marketing at a series of venture-backed startups. I think in total I did 7. Part of the reason why there's so many is 6 of those were acquired. So through acquisition, I ended up working in a bunch of bigger companies. About 8-9 years ago, I made the switch to consulting. And so what I do now is I work with technology companies, and my focus is very narrowly on positioning, which is helping companies get really, really clear on how they win in the market. The other thing I do with companies is we take that positioning and we translate it into a really clear, compelling sales pitch that their sales teams can use. Yeah, so that's what I do. That's me.
I mean, positioning, the question which directly comes to my mind, when is it a topic? Is it a topic for Series B or later? Is it a topic for pre-seed you should think about directly from the start? When is this a good point of time to start thinking about it?
Well, if you think about what positioning is, like positioning defines how we win in the market. Like it defines how our product is the best in the world at delivering something like some value that a well-defined set of customers cares a lot about. So even if we're pre-launch, like if we're just have an idea for a product, you will have some positioning. You might not call it that, but you will have at least a thesis about who do I compete with? How am I different? What is the value that we can deliver that no one else can? What are the kinds of customers that are really going to love this stuff? What's the market we intend to go in? Now, your thesis might not be correct because you haven't launched it yet. And so your first wave of customers is really all about testing that thesis. Like, was I right on my guesses there or was I not? And after that first wave of customers, generally the positioning gets much tighter and you know exactly where you need to go run at, you know, what does a best fit customer look like? What exactly is the value that I'm delivering? That's what we're doing in the early days of a startup. Most of the companies I work with, you know, they kind of run the gamut, but most of them are in market. They've got a product, they're making revenue, but what they have is a gap between what an existing happy customer understands about the product and what a new prospect thinks coming in. Like new prospects are coming in going, I don't know, man, I'm not really sure what this thing is. And you can hear it in sales calls, especially initial sales calls, where the customer will come in and they'll be like, I don't know, like back up, pitch it to me again. Like, what is it again? And companies will tell me, like, sometimes customers don't get it on the first call. It takes a second call or a third call. Sometimes what you'll get is confusion around exactly what the thing is. Like, customers will come in and say, oh, you're exactly like Salesforce. And you're nothing like Salesforce. Like, you're not in that market. You don't have anything like it. And so you're getting compared to things that you shouldn't get compared to. Or the worst one is customers will come in and they'll be like, oh, I get it. I get what you are. I just don't get why I would pay for that. And so what you have is a situation where customers understand what you do. They just don't get your value. So if any of those things are true, then I would say we have a positioning problem and we need to work to tighten it up.
So you already mentioned a lot of things which come into positioning. Yeah. So there is the right customers, the right value proposition. Sounds like a lot of things coming into one pool. How can I as a founder maybe structure it or segment it to not stand in front of Mount Everest and will never climb up here? So what's a good approach of slice it down, like if I would like to start thinking about it?
Well, this is part of the work that I've been focused on for the last 9 years is like, how do we actually do positioning? Like, positioning as a concept has been around for ages. Like, there were these guys called Rees and Trout that wrote a book in 1982 called Positioning: The Battle for Your Mind. And so we've been talking about positioning since the 80s. It's sort of a fundamental, foundational marketing concept. But what I found when I started working in the early part of my career in product marketing, we had a good definition of positioning, but we did not have a well-defined methodology to go and do it. And that drove me a little bit crazy. So it seemed like every marketer that I talked to was just kind of making it up as they went along. So my background is in engineering. And when I decided to approach this, how do we do positioning problem, I thought the easiest way to do it would be, we kind of look at it like an engineering problem. Like, so let's break it down into its component pieces, solve for the component pieces, figure out how to put them together, voila, good positioning. Breaking positioning down into pieces actually isn't that hard. It turns out we kind of all in agreement what the pieces are. And so I think there's five. The first one is competitive alternatives. So what would a customer do if you didn't exist? Competitive alternatives typically are comprised of anybody that lands on a short list against you in a purchase process, but also whatever the status quo is, what the customer is doing to solve the problem today, which is often things that don't look like you at all. Like, it's using a spreadsheet. In B2B software, it's usually using a spreadsheet, manual processes, using some monolith software. Like, you know, I can kind of get this done with my accounting package, but not really. So that's the first thing. Competitive alternatives, what do we have to position against? The second thing is differentiated or unique capabilities. So what do we got that the alternatives don't have? We start by thinking about this feature function wise, that's capabilities of the product or capabilities of the company. And then we get to the third piece, which is differentiated value. So customers don't actually care all that much about your features. What they care about is, what can those features deliver for my business? So what is the value that you can deliver that the other guys can't? That's what's important in positioning. The next piece is best fit customers. So we're not trying to sell to everybody. We're trying to sell to customers that are a good fit for our stuff. So how do we define a best fit customer? Excuse me. And then the last component is market category, which is kind of the answer to the question, what are we? Like, are we email or are we chat? Are we a database or are we a business intelligence tool? So it's kind of the context that we wrap around our product or our company that is sort of a first step for people understanding or trying to understand what we're all about. So we have those five component pieces. That's how I like to think about it. We break that down. And then the rest of the methodology is about how do we get the right answer for those five things.
This is, I think, where we go into in a second part. I'd love to, everybody. I have a couple of questions of understanding to the five categories,
sure.
I think, or just maybe to explain it a bit more. So you said, okay, the market category as the last point and competitive alternatives in the first. Isn't the one defining the other? So if I compete at the first segment against Salesforce or HubSpot, I'd probably be in the CRM category. Or how does these two work together?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. For a long time, I struggled with this, whether we should start with market category or should we start with competitive alternatives. The problem is if we start with market category, there's a chance we get it wrong. There's a chance we get it wrong. So sometimes I've worked at companies where we thought the market category that we should be in was one thing, but it turned out shifting into a different market category actually really helped us sell a lot. So I'll give you an example. I had a company that I was working for, and it was founded by two guys, and they PhDs in database technology, and they built this thing. It's a database. It's a fancy new revolutionary database. And what this database does is it does a certain kind of needle in a haystack query very, very, very fast. So their original first customer was a big bank, and the big bank had a handful of queries on a huge amount of data that took so long to do, they had to run it over the weekend. Like, that's how long it was. And these guys had this new database that if you ran that query, they could do it in 3 minutes. So,
okay.
You know, revolutionary thing, amazing. But when we went to sell that thing, you know, we went out and we'd walk into a room full of database administrators and maybe the chief information officer, whoever's in charge of database stuff. And we would be like, hi, we're here to sell you a fancy new database. And the minute that word came out of our mouth, you could see everybody in the room just kind of like, oh boy, you know, picking up their phone, not paying attention. And, you know, and the first few pitches I did on this thing, you know, the senior person in the room would put their hand up and be like, you know what? You know, we got a database. We're an Oracle shop. We're standardized on Oracle. We're all certified on Oracle. Like, we get it. Your thing does this query fast, but we use databases for all kinds of things. And, you know, we're not super in love with Oracle. Like, we know it's got problems, but we're not bringing in another database platform. Like, that's just not going to happen.
Never change it at all.
Right. We're not changing that. And really, if you took a step back and you looked at what we did very well, what we did very well looked a bit more like a data warehouse. The value we delivered was really around analytic queries and being able to do a really fast analytic query. And that's something that you don't often do. Like, a regular database is not often used for that kind of analytic workload. Like, if you really wanted to solve that kind of analytic workload, you buy a data warehouse. So if we had done the positioning and started with the market category, we'd have said, database, what else could we be? I mean, obviously it's a database. What else could we be? But if we had gone to our good fit customers that we were already working with and said, hey, if we didn't exist, what would you do? Every one of those customers would have said, well, we'd build a data warehouse. Mm-hmm. So even though we thought, you know, we're database people, we're building a database here, you know, customers did not contextualize us that way at all. What really unlocked this for me is, you know, when I was trying to figure this stuff out, I got really into jobs theory. Are you familiar with Clayton Christensen, Jobs to be Done, Jobs Theory?
Yes.
So there's a really famous story in Jobs Theory about the milkshake. So if you're familiar with this, the milkshake story is, you know, there's this fast food company and they want to build a better milkshake, basically. So they look at all the data of who's buying milkshakes and what are they, you know, how many milkshakes do we sell and what kind of milkshakes sell a lot? And what they see is that a lot of people are buying milkshakes in the drive-through lane in the morning. And they're like, what the heck is going on here? So then they analyze this and they interview a bunch of people. And these people have these long commutes, long, boring commute, and they're in their car. So they don't want to have a donut or an egg sandwich. It's messy. That'll get all over their suit. And they're dressed. So they want something that fits in the cup holder. But, you know, a milkshake is good because it's thick and it takes a long time to drink one. So it's boredom relief, you know, for my long drive to get to the office. And so as a result of this knowledge from the customers, what they did was they made the milkshake thicker and they made sure that the thing fit in the cup holder and blah, blah, blah. But when I listened to that story, I was like, aha, what actually we discovered there was competitive alternatives. Because we thought we were competing against Coke. We thought we were competing against water. And what we're actually competing against is a donut or a breakfast sandwich.
Yeah.
So by starting our positioning at this competitive alternative, we actually get inside the minds of customers. Like the question is really, if you didn't exist, what would they do? The question is not, who do we think our competitors are?
Very
the question is, what would a customer do as an alternative thing, which kind of bakes in, you know, and if you're in market and you're selling things and you know who ends up on a short list, you know what the status quo is in the account. And so then we can build the positioning from there. If we start with market category, how do we know we have the best one? There's nothing to compare it to. It's just our own biases about what we wish our market category was or what we believe our market category is, but we could be wrong. And a lot of times I've worked in companies where we were wrong. We thought we were one thing. It turned out we were much better positioned in a different category altogether.
Completely understood, Apple. And I think this makes complete sense. Another trade-off which comes to my mind, or not a trade-off, but like the question, like what's first, chicken, egg, maybe.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you're relating to, like unique capabilities and differentiated value. Yeah. Because if I'm thinking from a logical way, I think, okay, I need first unique capabilities to then like really extract a differentiated value compared to competitors or an existing solution. But of course, could be also wrong. Yeah. Maybe it makes more sense to think first about, okay, what could be a differentiated value and then match it to my internal capabilities. So how to think about this two dimensions?
Right. In my mind, we have to start with capabilities. There's no question because the capabilities drive the value. Like we're not trying to decide. Here's a fundamental thing for people to understand about positioning. Positioning is all about how do we get to the best possible story that helps us sell the thing we have in the market right now against the competitors we have right now. This is not a strategy session where we're trying to figure out what should we build for next year or, you know, where, what's the vision of this thing? Where is it going? No. We're just trying to like sell the heck out of the thing we have right now versus the competitors we have right now. So we start with this stake in the ground of, you know, if we didn't exist, what would a customer do? So that's the alternatives in the minds of customers. And then we go to, well, what have we got that they don't have? Like, we got a whiz-bang AI thing. So what? Like, why does a customer care about that thing? We have this particular feature. So what? Why does a customer care? I can't start with value because I don't know what the value is. I don't know. Like, we're not just talking about any kind of value. We're talking about differentiated value, the value that you've got that no one else has. We don't get to make that up. It doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from our differentiated capabilities. That's why we got to start there. So, and the other thing is that it's easy. We know what our capabilities are. We can list them. We can put them all on a whiteboard. It's the easy part of a positioning exercise is saying, what do we got that they don't have? The hard part is then figuring out, well, what's the value of that? Mm-hmm. So I have advanced AI capabilities, blah, 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 blah. So what?
So what?
So that saves me time doing a task. So what? Mm-hmm. So that means I can have a smaller team of people doing that task. It's going to save you money. It's going to save me money. That's value. So that's what we're trying to get to in a positioning exercise, because my marketing and sales efforts are going to be, look, you want to pick me because I'm the only one that can help you save money in this way. And here's how much money I can save you. The other guys can't do that because they don't have this AI thing that allows me to do it.
So the AI thing is the capability and the differentiated value is the cost saving here.
Yeah.
If you talk about value differentiation, April, what could be other dimensions than saved costs, which makes it really touchable and to experience for a customer. So saving costs.
Here's the thing about differentiated value when we're in B2B. If we're selling to businesses, if I extract something out to pure value, like textbook, marketing school value, we only have two things. We're either helping you make money or we're helping you save money. There's actually a third thing, which is reducing risk, but we only hit that if we're in cybersecurity or insurance or something. But, it's mainly make money, save money. That's all we got. We only have two things. So we have to be very careful when we're translating from capabilities to value that we say, okay, we have this capability, so what? Well, so it helps me do this. Well, so what? Well, because that's going to help you, reduce the cost of whatever, or you're going to make more money doing whatever. We have to be a little bit careful. If we abstract all the way out to just makes money, saves money, because that's the only value that we could deliver in B2B, you're going to sound just like everybody else. Like everybody's out there making money, saving money. have to go, so what, to the exact point where a customer in their mind can do the translation to make money, saves money. Now, sometimes that means we have to go all the way to makes money, saves money. Sometimes that means we go all the way. Like, you're going to save money. This is how much. This is how you're going to do it. This is how. Sometimes we can stop short of that
and
say, this task that used to take you 5 hours now takes you 2 minutes. And then the customer will go, oh, I get how that's going to make me money. And I don't actually have to go all the way. And then I can still preserve my differentiation because I'm talking about saving time. And then the customer knows why saving time is important. They already understand that. I don't have to go all the way to the end. So I got to be a little bit careful. I want to be able to talk about value, but I want to retain the differentiation. If I get to a value statement that any of my competitors can say, then it ain't differentiated anymore. I got to back it up a little bit and say the part that only we can enable this for your business. Here's why you should care. But we got to be careful. We're keeping that differentiation in there. We're not just getting out to, hey, we're going to save you some time. Yeah, us too. Hey, we're going to save you some money. Yeah, us too.
I really like this thinking. Everyone, I have a question here. Would you think that this depends a lot on the user persona? Because I can think about, okay, if I'm working on a very repetitive task in a company and I'm the user of the software, maybe I'm the champion and the influencer of the purchasing decision, I maybe, because I'm far away from the P&L, I don't really care if I save cost make more revenue. Maybe I'm really just depressed or like really tortured by my repetitive task, because something takes too long. So you say, like, okay, in this case, maybe it's way more useful to say, okay, the value comes off less repetitions, less time used, because it's also for the user or the buyer.
Because you inherently know why that's valuable. You're right.
Exactly.
Here's the way I like to think about it. In B2B, typically, if it's a bigger size deal, typically we're selling to a team of people. It's not just one person. Yes. So there will be somebody that's assigned as the champion for the deal. And that champion is going to have to work with all the other people. Like, maybe they got to work with IT and legal and purchasing and whoever else to get a deal done. And in order to get a deal done, they make the recommendation up to the manager, which is often the financial buyer. But there's generally a champion that makes this deal happen.
Yes.
Sometimes the champion's an end user and sometimes they're not. And the thing we have to really think about in positioning work is our positioning has to really, really resonate for the champion, because it is the champion that is tasked with figuring out how to make a purchase recommendation. And it is the champion that has to get consensus across everybody else and make the recommendation up to the financial buyer. Now, the other people involved in the deal. So think about it this way. The champion is the only person that can make a deal happen. All the other people can kill your deal. So it's not like they don't matter, but they matter in a different way. Generally, the other people are not so worried about value for the business. They're more worried about, well, how's this going to change my life? Is this thing going to be a pain in the neck for my life? So IT is like, well, it better meet the security requirements. Well, it better integrate with all our stuff. Well, it better whatever. The end users, if it's not the end users, the end user is like, well, it better be easy to use. Otherwise, I'm not going to use it. And so generally what we're doing in positioning is we really need the positioning to resonate with the champion. Sometimes that means getting ahead of the objections or potential objections of the other group because the champion's worried about this. Like, hey, you know, if it doesn't meet our security requirements, I can't even put you on the list because I know IT's going to kill it. Or they might be like, look, the last thing we had in here, the end users hated it and they refused to use it. So this one better be easy to use. Otherwise, I can't put you on the short list. So the positioning needs to really resonate for that champion. And whatever value means to them. Like, so if they're the manager, it might be visibility across all the end users. It might be things they can do. It might be, you know, whatever that persona is worried about. But you may also need to address some of the potential objections, even in the first meeting, some of the potential objections of the other groups. And then even if I don't have to address it in the first meeting, my job as a salesperson or us as a vendor, once we get on the short list, in order to close a deal, we're going to have to help that champion handle the objections of everybody else. How are they going to get past IT and purchasing and legal and end users? How are they going to go up and convince their boss that this is a good use of the budget? We have to arm them with that. But that's not necessarily positioning. Again, the positioning needs to really work for the champion. Otherwise, we don't get on the short list. We don't even get a chance to work with the other people. So we really got to nail it for the champion. Understanding that in an early stage company is often a really, really hard thing to do. Like, who is the best champion? Often small companies, like early stage software startups, they will just assume that the end user is the best person to be the champion, but often they have almost no power to make a purchase. So you'll see things like a product like Growth Motion, where we're trying to get the end users using it in a free way. And then once we have a certain number of end users, then we come in and we try to sell to the person up above them that actually has budget and has the power to make a deal, get a deal done. And we can come up and then work on a deal up above them once we see a certain amount of traction with end users and we know we've taken the end user objection off the table. But it doesn't always work like that. Sometimes end users have absolutely no power in the deal. Yeah, sure. And then in the deal, we don't worry about them as much as we worry about maybe other constituents like IT or purchasing.
Brand positioning is one important topic which is relevant sooner or later for almost every software company. And the same counts for our partner, Flex Capital. All internet and software entrepreneurs should listen up now. Are you at a crucial point with your internet or software company? Are you considering selling a part of your business, or do you want to take your company to the next level? Today, I want to introduce you to Flex Capital, a fund that completely rethinks the concept of private equity. Flex Capital steps in exactly where traditional capital providers reach the limits. Why? Because Flex Capital is not just an investor. They are trailblazers. All partners and the majority of investors behind the fund are software entrepreneurs who understand your business and can provide crucial support for the next steps in growth. With Flex Capital, you receive not just financial support, but a whole set of operational tools and a team of experts specialized in professionalizing companies while simultaneously increasing their efficiency, profitability, and market value. With Flex Capital by your side, you can significantly reduce your private financial risk as an entrepreneur, scale your company from an EBITDA of 1 million euros to 10 million euros and beyond, and lay the foundation for your next big exit, supported by a team that has already walked this path. Ready for the next step? Then visit us at flex.capital and discover how Flex Capital can help take your company to the next level together with you.
Super interesting learning. So positioning needs to work for the champion, not for the economic buyer, if it's not the same thing. I think this is a narrative which needs to be very clear, because you can go in a completely wrong direction at certain points, as you said.
But, you know, sometimes the champion is the economic buyer, but if they're separate, you have to be careful, because again, it's the champion that's going to make the case to the economic buyer. But it's the champion that's really sticking their neck out. Like, it's the champion that's going to get fired if this thing all goes sideways. Not the economic buyer.
And promoted if it goes right. Yeah. So this is
and promoted if it goes right. That's it. So it's hard being a champion. Like, we really have to crawl inside the minds of these people. And again, we have to be careful that we're picking the right champion. Like, do we have a persona that can get this deal done? Because if they have no power to get the deal done, we got the wrong champion. We got to go find somebody else.
I got a good feeling I prefer this five dimensions. Still, what's like a big question mark in my head of, okay, how do we get this into a sequential like process of steps, like to really work this through? And if you are in, I would say like, hey, April, I'm a founder of a, let's say, of an applicant tracking system. Yeah, it's a crowded market, ATS. I'm seed stage. I have a good team. And I never thought about positioning, to be very honest. But I got your book, like one of your two books. I ran through some first chapters. I really liked it, but now I'm starting the process of how to do it. And I'm honored. I feel honored that you take 30 minutes time with me as a founder. So please help me, guide me through how, as a founder of an ATS, how can I work out a positioning?
Right. So I think it works like this. So we start with, if we're in market and I've got customers. And
let's say we have 10, 15 customers. We are in the market.
15 customers. We might have enough customers to really do this. We might not. I think there'd be value in doing the exercise regardless. Mm-hmm. We might need to adjust it when we get another 10, 15 customers. We might need to relook at it and see if our guess was right. But let's say we have 10, 15 customers. Again, we're going to start with competitive alternatives. If I look across those 10, 15 customers, what was the status quo that we were replacing in the account? So maybe it was a spreadsheet. Maybe it was, you know, pen and paper. Maybe it was just manual documents. Or maybe they had some old legacy applicant tracking system that wasn't doing the job anymore. And then who else landed on the short list? Because like you say, it's a competitive market. There's lots of other applicant tracking systems over there. But one thing to remember is I don't have to compete with all of them. In fact, I don't compete with all of them. I only compete with the ones that my customers put on a short list. So who are those? I've done 15 deals. I should know. So
yes, my customers are German industry things. And you are right. Probably the alternative before was Excel. And I'm really focused on, let's say, industry profiles, which are not coming via LinkedIn. So they are more like different sources. And my ATS has I think my ATS has a USP in it's perfect for industry profiles, like engineers and stuff like this.
Okay. So those are the alternatives. So I write those down. Then I go to the next step and I'm like, well, what do you got that they don't have feature function wise, like capabilities? Yeah. And you know, you might start, and you could start with either one. You could start with the ones that are on the short list. So your industry ones, your German country ones. And you would list all the features you have that they don't have. And I would start with the most important ones. You know, let's list them out, all of them. And then I would go through that list. And then I would look at, well, if you were just doing it with Excel and whatever, what are the capabilities that you have versus doing it with an Excel sheet? Like, oh, we can save this thing, or we can automatically bring this stuff in, or we could whatever. So we write all that stuff down. So this step, it's not unusual for us to have like a whiteboard full of stuff, like all kinds of stuff. Then we get to the next step where we want to start thinking about value. So there's two things we're going to do. The first one is we're going to go down that list of differentiated capabilities, and we'll start with the big things. Mm-hmm. And so we pick the first big feature and we'll say, so what? You have this, you know, automated thing, whatever. So what? Why does a customer care? What's the value of that? I'm going to write that value down, and then I'm going to go down the list And here's the thing. I don't want 200,000 points of value. I might have 59 features that are differentiated, but I don't want 59 points of value. I want two, three, maybe just one. But so what I'm looking for is I take the first big one. I figure out the value for that. Then I look down the list and say, are there other things that actually contribute to that value? If I did the translation, it would be that same value point. Usually there's a bunch. Then I go to the next big thing and say, well, what's the value of that? Let's write it down. And then again, look down the list and say, oh, yeah, that would map in there. That would map in there. And so we're trying to get to, again, two, 3 points of value where we say, look, at the end of this step, you should be able to say, look, we're the only applicant tracking system that that delivers this plus this plus this value. And the features are tucked in underneath. Like, this is how we do it.
Okay.
So now I've got differentiated value. So here's my three differentiated value themes. That's great. Then I go to the next step where I say, look, I can sell this thing to anybody that needs applicant tracking, but not everybody cares the same about the value that only we can deliver. So if I'm looking at these three applicant track, these three value points for my applicant tracking thing, I'm asking myself, like, who cares about that? So in your case, maybe you've got something that does this great thing for LinkedIn. And so then you're saying, well, you only care about that if you're pulling applicants from LinkedIn. Well, are there certain kinds of companies that are more likely to be pulling a lot of applicants from LinkedIn versus others? Like, is it certain industries? Is it certain job titles? Is it companies that have a lot of those job titles? You're asking yourself that question. So what you're trying to get to is a list of characteristics of a target account that you can say, look, if they tick these boxes, then they really, really need the value that they're only going to get from us. And this is who we should be chasing in our marketing and in our sales efforts. That's and very, then once I have that, then I can get to market category. So then I get to market category and I say, okay, I've got these 3 points of value. I'm trying to go after customers that look like this. Am I an applicant tracking system? Is that really what I am? Or am I something more specific than that? And that's the question. Like, if I say I'm applicant tracking, does that kind of point those best fit customers towards what you do? Or does that make them think you do a bunch of stuff that you don't actually do? So what is the best way to contextualize the value that you're delivering? Maybe there's a better way to describe it.
One challenge I'm seeing, April, but tell me like how you solve it with your clients, is maybe I'm a founder and I predefined my ICPs and personas, and then I'm doing the exercise as I learned, and out of the value I dedicated, deducted, I then define potential target groups to for whom this value could fit.
Yeah.
And now I'm doing this exercise and I'm recognizing, Jesus, like my initial ICPs I thought of and I directed my whole company to.
Yeah.
And what comes out of my positioning exercise, unfortunately, they don't fit together.
Yes, we call this the oh shit moment.
The oh shit moment, okay. Oh shit.
Where you get there and you're like, oh, occasionally this happens. Generally, it doesn't. Like,
okay,
the majority of cases, it doesn't, because that would be weird. Like, you were trying to go after this thing, but you somehow built a product that doesn't address the needs of those people at all. So that would be a little weird. But sometimes what we do get is we'll look at the value, and then we'll look at like the list of customers we have in the pipeline, and not all of them care a lot about that value, which means we've got a lot of deals in the pipeline that we're not likely to win because we don't really have great value for them. And we are not orienting our marketing and sales efforts to go after the exact bullseye of where we do win. That's more common. So it's more common, we'll get to the thing. So I'll give you an example. I worked with a company and they did, it was like appointment setting for big businesses, like big multinational businesses. So think it's like Calendly, except the appointment setting was for, you know, you want to make an appointment with your financial advisor, and they have offices all over the place and different advisors with different expertise. And so this thing, you could say, you know, here's where I am, and this is the expertise I want, and it would match you with the right one, and then schedule it and do it, whatever. So, you know, we went through and we looked at the value, and one of their big differentiators was this ability to match you with the best person in a location that was close to your house. So they would make it really convenient to get a really, you know, a really good match. You're getting the right person in the right place. That's very differentiated from every other scheduling thing that they were competing against. Now, if you looked at some of the deals they had in their pipeline, they just didn't care about that. They didn't have multiple locations. They didn't have multiple products. They didn't have multiple areas of expertise. You know, it was really the only thing they had was, you know, they were trying to sell a deal with a drugstore where you could make an appointment to go get your makeup done. All that mattered was the location, and you were just going to go to the one that was closest. Like, whereas financial services had that, really, really had that. And so what they ended up doing as a result is really narrowing down. When we got to the market category, it was really appointment setting for financial services, because financial services was such a good fit for that. And it's such a big business. So, you know, in the United States, they have credit unions. There's millions of them. They're all over the place. They could focus just on credit unions and make all kinds of money, you know, which is kind of what they did. So sometimes what you'll get to that ICP step, you'll realize that you were maybe going a bit too broad, and there's a reason why you're losing a lot of deals, is because you don't actually have value for these people that's better than your competitors. And you'd be better to narrow it in on this thin slice and just chase after that. Now, the other corollary to this oh shit moment is sometimes you get there and what you realize is you have a product, it has great differentiated value, but the size of the market that cares about that value is very small.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we in tech, we don't care if it's very small in the long term, because we're building the product to address a bigger and bigger market as we go along. So if we looked at it and said, well, you know, I wouldn't want to tell the VC that that's my addressable market, it's pretty small, but it's big enough to make my number this year and next year, that's fine. In my mind, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Go run at that, but you better be building stuff to get to a bigger market after that. Sometimes we get to this point in the thing and we look at it and we're like, I'm not even sure that's big enough to make the number this year. Then you're truly in trouble. Then we have a product problem. Like, we need to go build something, because what it tells us is, we have differentiated value, but there's not enough people out there that really care about that. We're going to need to go build some stuff to expand that market that we can address right now.
Super interesting thoughts, April. So what I take out of this, especially in the first example you mentioned, is that doing the positioning exercise also really much helps me to sharpen my ICP. And of course, then also like really to increase the quality of my pipeline and the attribution of my resources, because a more sharp, better pipeline will save me a lot of time and resources and money at my SDRs and AEs, probably, and
exactly.
Will, of course, lift conversion upwards on the deal. Got it. Really, really, really interesting thinking. I mean, having done this, or probably you did this exercise with a lot of your clients multiple times, and
hundreds.
For me it would be hundreds, probably like really hundreds of times. For me it would be interesting, what are typical patterns you see in terms of mistakes people are usually doing before they work with you? Like, so what's the one, two, maybe three things which you see really, really often where people really do something wrong?
Yeah, there's a handful of things. The first one is not really understanding who you have to position against. Often, companies will, it's a combination of things. They'll either have a very, very long list of competitors, like a super long list of competitors, you know, when in reality, there's only two that we see ending up on a short list. So they make it very, very difficult. So they're positioning against a lot of competitors they don't actually see in deals. And so they're watering down their positioning because they're trying to position against this long list of little guys that are really just a ghost. Like they're, yeah. You know, your customer doesn't know them, but they're living in your head. That's one thing. The second thing is they're not considering status quo to be competition at all. Mm-hmm. And so you'll get things like, you know, I've seen it a lot where people are trying to position around ease of use because they think they're much easier to use than their direct competitor. But the problem is the status quo they're fighting against is like an intern or manual labor, which is extremely easy to use. So they're talking about ease of use, but, you know, you're not going to be easier to use than the intern. So you're not going to win that deal. So we need to take into account what the status quo is as well, and not just direct competitors. And then we need to make sure that our direct competitors are ones that actually end up on a short list, not, you know, what I found out from a Google search of companies that could compete with me. They kind of sound like me, but we actually never, ever, ever see them in a deal. So that's the most common mistake I get. The second thing is that's really common in tech companies is they're positioning around features rather than the value of the features.
Yes.
Sometimes if we have a very technical audience, a very technically savvy audience, sometimes we can talk about the feature and the audience is technical enough to understand the value. Like if I'm selling, you know, if I'm selling cell phone, a camera on the cell phone, I can say my camera is 100 megapixels and everybody knows what a megapixel is. And we know 100 is better than 20 and we know why it's better and all that stuff. But if you're selling some AI thing, your customers may have no idea what the value of that is. And we're going to have to be clearer on what the value is and not just assume that the customer can do the work of translating your features to value. So we have to be careful about that. The third thing is that, you know, when you're, if you're talking too much about features, what you've got is a very, very long list of things.
Yeah.
And it's too much stuff for the customer to hold in their mind. And so we need to simplify that down to, look, here's the value we can deliver for you. It's A, B, C. And you don't have to remember all the features. What you really need to do is remember the value. The features are just how we get it done. So the reason you want to pick us over our biggest competitor is because we can do ABC. They can't do it. This is why that's important for your business. The features are just how we do it. And so if I'm hitting them with a list of 100 features, maybe they take away that stuff. Maybe they don't. I don't know. I think it's too hard for people to figure out. So I think we need to get really oriented around value, mm-hmm. not features. And then we need to make sure that that value is differentiated against our true list of competitors, not just who we think should compete with us.
Identifying this true list of competitors, Apple. I mean, as you said, probably if I'm a very young founder in the early stages, what I'm doing is, okay, I'm starting at Google. You said, yeah. the result could be an endless list of competitors. I assume the best thing is talk to your existing customers, potential customers, ask them very clearly who was on the shortlist together with me and why, and thereof get a feeling for the competition. I mean, of course, on an ongoing path, like growing and tenure, you will understand this by nature. But I mean, if you're very early, I think this could be a challenge sometimes because you don't have transparency about the market. Huh?
That's it. So in the early days, if I'm doing, you know, if I believe in lean startup stuff, while I'm building the product, I'm having customer discovery conversations with potential customers. And I'd be asking them, like, how do you solve this problem right now? So I understand what the status quo is. And then I'd also be asking them, like, okay, if the status quo really wasn't working for you, who would end up on your short list? What sort of things would you be looking at? That's going to give me a clue. But again, customers often lie, or it's a theoretical question. Like when they get into the actual situation, sometimes they're doing something totally different.
Yeah.
If we have salespeople involved in the deal, then we know, because a good salesperson is going to find out what the status quo is. A good salesperson is going to find out who else is on the short list and who we're competitive with. If we don't have salespeople and it's a completely zero touch sales model, then we're going to need to interview customers to find that out, because we don't know. We're just guessing until we actually go get the research, the data that tells us what's actually going on. In those situations, like, we want to be doing we want to be having a conversation with the customer that sounds a lot like a jobs interview, like a job to be done interview. Like we want to go in and say, okay, take me back before you bought us. Like, take me back. What were you doing before? You know, so I understand what the status quo was. I want to find out like what happened that made you wake up in the morning and say, we can't keep doing it like that. So the jobs people call this the struggling moment. What was the struggling moment where you said, you know what, we can't, you know? And so we need to understand that because that's the trigger that gets somebody into a purchase process. So we need to show up there. We need to ideally speak to that trigger in our marketing. And then we want to understand how they make a shortlist. So we want to ask them like, so what else did you look at? How did you make a shortlist? Were there criteria to get on the shortlist or off the shortlist? Did you talk to your friends? What resources did you do? Did you Google? Where did you go? What did you look at? How did you make the shortlist? And then and that's important for us in marketing to make sure that we show up in these places where people do their research. And then the next question is, so you picked us. Why, you know, why did you pick us? Obviously, we want to understand that. But the other question I like to ask is, why not the other guys? Because sometimes, especially in startups, sometimes we don't win because we were better. We win because the other guys messed up. So we want to understand that, like, you know, what happened over there. And then the last question I like to ask is, because it's important for our positioning. Now that you bought the product, you're using the product, is there anything that you find surprising, good or bad? And it, you know, if it's a bad surprise, like, oh, I just assumed you guys would do this, but it turns out you don't, and that was a bummer, you know, or I assumed it would work this way and it didn't. That there could be something in our positioning that's triggering that people think we should be able to do this and we don't. Like, and maybe it's a gap we need to fill in the product. Maybe not. Maybe it's something we can fix in our positioning. It goes when it's good stuff too. Sometimes people will say, I had no idea you did this thing and it's incredible. Like, I love it. You know, and you're like, man, we need to pull that into positioning because it shouldn't be, there shouldn't be good surprises after you buy. We should put all our good stuff out front. So that's how I like to do one of those interviews back when I was doing interviews like that. But again, if you have salespeople, they know a lot of this stuff. They know a lot. Like, they know what status quo is. They know who ends up in a short list. They generally know what the customer's thinking and why they picked us, why they didn't pick the other guys. You know, if they don't know that, then we could do win interviews and get it quite easily.
Absolutely right. But I think I like your point of, okay, there are salespeople in the qualification process or in the decision process. Nevertheless, you say like, okay, it's also important to talk to customers after onboarding, after activation, when they are existing customers and they give you surprising information in this feedback loop. And I can also say I recommend to my portfolio founders, also talk to people who declined and got lost in the deals. Don't approach them to resell them again and try to sell them again, but approach them for like a 30 minutes honest interviews and okay, we're very early. We like to know why not and against whom did we lose. I think there's also a lot of value if people are open-minded to tell you why they decided for someone else, especially in early days, to adapt positioning, to really understand a bit better.
We got to be careful. Like, in my opinion, because I've worked a lot of early stage companies and I used to always do win-loss analysis. And in fact, I found most of the early stage companies when I worked there, everybody was obsessed with the losses, like just absolutely obsessed with the losses. Why did we lose? Oh my gosh, let's go talk to them and we'll figure out why we lost. And what I found in doing loss analysis was a whole bunch of stuff I couldn't do anything about.
True.
Like, so much stuff I couldn't do. Like, there was either big functionality that we knew that was a miss, you know, and we're working on it, but it's so far in the future, we're always going to lose deals like that. Or I'd find out, you know, the customer was worried because we were too small or, you know, things, again, a lot of things I couldn't do anything about. Or it was just, you know, we went with the other guys because they were the market leader. You know, we went with the other guys because we had a relationship with the sales rep and we didn't actually have salespeople on the ground, things like that. Whereas win analysis, there's so much stuff you can do with what you learn there, like so much you could do. Like, it's telling you the whole blueprint for how to go get more customers that look like that. So win analysis, in my opinion, super, super, super valuable, particularly to an early stage company. Loss analysis, like, you're going to get some stuff there, but I think that companies focus too much on the losses. And when you're small, like, look, there's a thousand reasons to say no to you. There are vanishingly, vanishingly small reasons to say yes.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree.
We should literally be treating every deal like the tiny miracle it is and be like, what happened that made this one go?
How did this work? How the hell?
Right. Yeah, and can we replicate that? Can we do it again? I think we need to be obsessed about wins. Losses, yeah, okay. If you got time, we'll do those. But if I only had enough time to pick between wins and losses, well, I pick wins all day. Like, wins all day.
wins all day. You heard it, guys and folks. If someone wins all day, it's also a good lifestyle motto. April, wins all day. I like it for a book title. Maybe book is a good word here. If I got interested, I think a lot of listeners understood the value positioning can have and how it can influence the development of a whole company. What's a good way to get a little bit deeper into the topic? What would you recommend if someone is like curious now after listening to our today's episode?
Yeah, so everything I know about positioning, I wrote into a book called Obviously Awesome. And you can buy that book, and it's designed as a how-to book for positioning, like step one, step two, step three, step four. So it's designed to help a tech founder that wants to get their arms around this stuff. It's very prescriptive. That's what it's all about. I have a second book that describes how do we take that positioning and turn it into a good sales pitch? Because I think a lot of good positioning, even when you do the work to get really good positioning, often the marketers do a good job of making it live in marketing, but it doesn't always survive the jump over to sales. And I think a lot of companies struggle with, you know, their sales pitches are just feature walkthroughs. It's just a flow of features. So how do we actually do a good job in a first call with a prospect of clearly answering the question, why pick us over the other guys? So we're going to take that positioning and turn it into a really sharp sales pitch. That's what the second book is about. It's called Sales Pitch, obviously. So those are two good things. I write a newsletter and some stuff, but I think if you want to go deep on the positioning stuff, what I would recommend, you know, the book, there's an audio book too, if you're not into reading, but I also did a podcast series where I go really deep on individual questions that I get a lot in positioning. Mm-hmm. And so if you go to my website, aprildunver.com, and you click on podcast, you can listen to those. And that's basically me trying to tell you everything that didn't make it into the book in terms of specific little questions that I get asked a lot. I think that's another good resource.
I think these are super valuable tips and resources.
I'm also coming to speak at some conferences, and maybe you can see me there.
I wanted to say, and if you're afterwards, after reading the books and listen to the podcast, then still have questions to April, then please come to Artist Summit in October. I learned, April, it's the first time you're speaking in Germany.
I have never spoken at a conference in Germany. I don't know why that is, but I'm fixing it this year, man. 2024, that's the year I come to Germany. I'm so excited. I've done lots of stuff in Europe too. I don't know why not Germany.
It's a very underdeveloped market here in Germany, so we can understand. We are very happy to have you in October.
I am stoked.
Big pleasure that you're coming over. Thanks a lot for sharing this valuable insights with us, April. Taking the time today. Before you're allowed to leave, I have a last question which does not have anything to do with positioning.
Oh, no.
It's our restaurant questions. You know, like our audience is very much into food, and we are always asking our guests. I think you're based in Toronto, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm based in Toronto.
Is there a place, could be breakfast, lunch, dinner, could be a burger place or a Michelin restaurant where you said, like, okay, if our artists are in Toronto, this is the one place they should definitely go for getting some good food.
Goodness.
Only one recommendation.
Only one?
Only one for this time.
All right. Well, I'm giving you the best one then. So the best one is a restaurant called Allo. Mm-hmm. A-L-O. Fantastic. It's a beautiful space. It's right downtown. The food is incredible. It's French-ish, but I don't know if I would really call it French. The only problem is that you need to be organized because it is a Michelin star. We've only recently had the Michelin people come to Toronto, but you know, of course, this place was doing a good job, so they're on the list. But it's very hard to get a reservation, so you need to plan in advance. So when you know you're coming to Toronto, plan in advance, make your reservation, and then here's the hot tip. They have a bar area in there, and it's more or less the same menu, and you can eat at the bar, and that you can actually get done. The other thing is they have kind of a low-end restaurant on the ground floor. The main restaurant is upstairs, but they have a low-end restaurant in the ground floor, which is also fantastic. Again, you need to book it in a little bit in advance, but it's easier to get in there than the Allo proper upstairs. That's my tip. Come to Toronto and eat there. Oh my God, it's so good.
It's a great tip. We put it to the show notes together with all the other information. Thank you very, very much, April. And I'm really much looking forward to welcoming you in Berlin in October. So thanks a lot for your time today and best wishes to Canada.
Hey, I'm super excited to come to Berlin. I can't wait. And thanks so much for having me on the show.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you everyone for tuning in to today's show and listening to April Dunford and myself, Julius Göllner. If you like to see April live the first time ever in Germany, then it's time to get your ticket for the Artist Summit in October, the 10th of October this year. Join 500 operators, VPs, founders and C-levels and 125 of the most well-known investors worldwide for the Artist Summit this year. As you know, the most curated and most valuable SaaS event for decision makers only we have in Europe. So please take a look at www.artist.net, start the registration and application process, and we would be happy welcoming you in Berlin during the Berlin SaaS Week 2024. Thank you and see you next week. This was Julius. Bye-bye.